You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a beautiful April day. And
as it's cloudy. It's dreary.
It's beautiful. Don, I have hummingbirds out here.
Oh, okay.
Yesterday we had 8 hummingbirds sitting at the feeder at the same time, sociably, and 2 more coming in trying to find empty spot. They've got to be families.
No, they're just trying to get out of the rain. It was raining yesterday.
it's in the rain. I
wonder if hummingbirds are scared by thunder and lightning, which we had yesterday in large amounts. Yeah, we had some thunderstorms. We had some hail. We had some localized downpours. Are these overwintering species of hummingbirds?
They live here all the time and they raise their babies here, which is why I think this is a family.
So it's Anna's hummingbird, or what's the other one?
This black chin.
And these are
black chin.
Are the migratory hummingbirds on their way?
When they migrate, they just go through. Like 2 weeks ago, I had a Rufus hummingbird here. It was only here for a few minutes because it kept going.
It's going to Canada. It's got a long flight ahead of it. So it just needs to get a little sugar and head up to the next feeder in, Red Bluff.
How are they finding my backyard feeder? That's the real question. I think that they have hummingbird flyway signs up there that say, down here, Jim's a good provider.
Going through how many cups of sugar a day right now?
2 to 4 cups of nectar.
That's very nice of you to help to fuel their long migration, as well as the ones that are resident locally. Does that now, if the hummingbirds are passing through, does that mean the white-crowned sparrows have left? You can only hope.
No.
Great, not. No connection. All right. So we've had about 1.5 to 2.5 inches of rain around the region in the last 72 hours. This has been a fairly slow, steady, pretty warm storm. And I'm looking at the rainfall map over the California Nevada River Forecast Center. Davis looks like we got about 1.5 inches, same in Vacaville. Higher rainfall totals over on the early slopes of the Sierra. So you've got 2.5 to even up to 4 inches of rain in, let's see where that one is, Olive Ranch, which is as you head up on Interstate 80. So we had good rainfall total. And what's interesting about that is that actually brings April above average for rainfall. The year to date, we're at about 16.5 inches. Our average rainfall total in this area is about 20.5 inches. It's the third week of April. Usually we only get 1 inch or less in May. So we're going to probably end the rainfall season below average, but only by 2 to 4 inches. Whereas prior to this little storm, things weren't looking so great. What I like about this 1.5 to 2 inches, this is a really good soaking. This has actually given a very thorough irrigation to newly planted plants. The vegetable garden has now gotten that hydration that I've been so concerned about for the last few weeks with people planting vegetables and flowers into soil. It was pretty dry. A little bit of rainfall we got a couple weeks ago, for example, just moistened the first few inches. Well, 1 to 2 inches should go down 1 to 2 feet. So I'm happy to see that kind of rainfall over the whole region. Coming up this week, looks like we're going to go out of rain and into sun. 73 degrees the day of the broadcast, Thursday. Thursday night, 47, still in the 40s at night, mostly clear. Friday, 72 degrees, partly sunny, mostly cloudy Friday night, 49 degrees. Saturday, 65 degrees and partly sunny, a little cold for this time of year. That's actually several degrees below average for late April in this area. Saturday night, 47 degrees, partly cloudy. Sunday, 67 again, mostly sunny. Sunday night, partly cloudy, 47. Monday, sunny, 70. Tuesday, sunny, 71. Nights still in the 40s. So the National Weather Service.
Nights in the 40s, what are we supposed to not plant?
Well,
nights are in the 50s?
I'm not even bothering to get the area ready for my peppers and eggplants and melons and things like that. I've mowed, you know, I've got the grasses mowed down. I'm just letting the straw break down as a mulch. And a little report on those tomatoes I planted 2 weeks ago, just as an experiment. Six tomato plants went in the ground on Wednesday, that would be the 8th. Yeah, Wednesday the 8th. Okay. We then had a very cold storm that weekend, and we've had cold temperatures ever since. And I can tell you, six very nice 1 gallon tomatoes still look almost exactly the same as when I planted them. They haven't put on a bit of new growth. The only difference is older leaves have turned yellow. New growth has turned purple. Technically, those are both nutrient deficiencies, but I happen to know they're being caused by cold soil. The soil is still colder than we like it. They're not being harmed, but they haven't grown.
They're just hunkering down and waiting.
Yeah, they haven't grown a bit. And their cousins, which were the same size plants in 1 gallon containers that are still up by my house under an overhang, have put on 6 inches of growth in that time period. Neither case have the flowers fallen off. I don't know if that's good or bad, honestly. I really don't focus that much on early tomato production. I think early blooms are usually going to be disappointing. Early fruit are usually going to be disappointing.
You're talking about the end rot, right?
Blossom end rot is a big problem on early fruit, particularly on some varieties. And I just don't think the flavor is going to be there because we don't have this, you know, the sun input to make the sugar in the plant in the fruit. But a lot of people are focused on early production. So I get this question, should I pick these flowers up? You know, why? Don't worry about it. See what happens. Just let the plant run its course. But I don't have high hopes for those blooms. I'm surprised they're still hanging on there. So I've gained nothing from early planting of the tomatoes, but I haven't lost anything either. The cold temperatures.
Well, you've lost 6 inches of growth.
Right. That's true. The ones in gallon cans are better looking plants at this point. My guess is, and I'll be planting some of those, not today because it's too muddy out there, but probably tomorrow or the next day. Still colder than I like, but I'll be putting some more in. I think we'll see that difference over the next few weeks. I will say this, since we get this question nearly every day. With tomatoes, they'll recover. They're vigorous vines, especially indeterminate ones. So you haven't lost anything. You just haven't really gained much. And in some cases, you will be set back in terms of growth, flowering, and yield because of the cold temperature, but they'll catch up. So why were you planting early? Well, just because you have the time or the space or whatever. With peppers and eggplant and melons in particular, they just not only don't benefit from going in early, it sets them back all season. Squash is kind of intermediate. Cucumbers are kind of intermediate. Basil does not like cold soil, does not like cold nights. Basil is not happy right now. Basil that you plant out is likely to decline pretty rapidly after you put it in the ground, unless we warm up quickly. And looking at the weather forecast, that just isn't going to happen. That happens to be convenient for me to say because none of my suppliers have basil this week because the demand has been so high for some of these things. KDRT is community radio. That means we're public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. Big day of giving is coming up in 2 weeks. We'll remind you next week about how helpful it is to all of your local nonprofit organizations to join in on this regional fundraising phenomenon called Big Day of Giving, or Big Dog, as we like to call it. Some of your favorite organizations like Tree Davis, Davis Media Access, KDRT are all there, and you can donate to us. We'll give you the details next week.
We also have things coming up, and this one I'm very excited about. I don't know if you ever heard of nature journaling. It's an interesting phenomenon, and I had one of the proponents of it, I think one of the initiators of it actually, on my radio show a while ago, and yeah. it was wonderful. But our local UC Davis Bee Haven is going to sponsor 2 nature journaling classes, and they're billed as Relaxed Mornings Among the Bees and Blossom. The beginning session for teens and adults is set for Saturday, May 2nd, and then there'll be a younger session for young explorers, kindergarten through 5th grade, and that'll take Sunday, May 3rd.
Beehaven.ucdavis.edu. And if you head over there, by the way, this is one of these little known resources in our area. It was started, I don't even remember how many years ago. It's out west of campus.
It's by the UC Davis Airport.
It is located on the UC Davis West Campus, adjacent to the Harriet Laidlaw Junior Honey Bee Research Facility on Bee Biology Road, on the way out to the UC Davis Primate Center, which is really pretty easy to find. It's open and free to the public daily. It's a garden of plants that attract bees. I mean, pretty basic mission there. Open from dawn to dusk, including weekends and holidays. No tickets are required. Just open the gate and walk in at your leisure. The gate being closed does not mean the garden is closed. It says right here, please relatch the gate behind you. There is no restroom available on the site, but a picnic table is available and it is ADA accessible. They do tours, but you can go there. I've got one staff person who heads out there about every month just to see what's in bloom, see if there's things that we should be propagating and selling at our nursery, because it's an amazing resource and it's almost never full of people. So it's you can go to the Arboretum, you can walk all around the Arboretum with crowds of people, then you can drive way out to this thing and walk in, get all kinds of inspiration from the plants that are just being allowed to informally grow there and to attract bees of all kinds, not honeybees just specifically, but a lot of native bees as well. Arboretum has two more sales coming up Saturday, May 2nd, the public plant sale. That's open to everyone, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. They do post the inventory shortly before the sale. So Saturday, May 2nd, and then Saturday, May 16th, they have a clearance plant sale, also open to everyone, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. So there are remaining two sales coming up, arboretum.ucdavis.edu for more information.
Okay, so I want to talk about a document that Don has handed me called April Garden Opportunities.
Yes, please.
And
please,
I say
please.
Activities.
Okay, but activities are fine. Just never say chores. Never say
jobs.
Tasks.
Yeah.
Never say work. Jobs. Yeah. Don't make it sound like work. It's the fastest way to turn off a kid about gardening. We got some jobs to do this weekend. No. Son, we have opportunities to do this weekend.
Yeah, okay. Right. Okay.
Yes. So after your cynical teenager rolls his eyes and goes back to his game, you say, all right, then we have things we have to do. Get up and do.
So tips for a better garden this year. The two most active times in the garden in our climate are October to November and April through May.
That sounds familiar.
These transitional periods, we can enrich the soil, plant the seasonal flowers and vegetables for the next 6 months, and plan and take action to control and prevent weeds.
Yeah, let's start right there, because what people are doing right now, and I think this is probably the key to success for a lot of people, that enrich the soil part. Simplest thing you can do, get some compost, preferably compost that has organic fertilizer of some sort already added to it. Spread that over the area where you're going to plant your vegetables, your flowers, whatever. And do that whenever ahead of time you want to. It doesn't have to be like right at the time you're installing the plants. In fact, in my opinion, probably better to dump some of that product, whether you buy it in bags or get something delivered or whatever, where you're going to plant, water it down. Right before rain is a great time to do it. Then you don't have to worry about this part. This is just to settle the dust and make that connection between the now moist compost and the soil below. Immediately upon doing that, we know that organisms from the soil move up into the compost and back and up and back. And we're talking not just earthworms, but all kinds of microbial action going on there between this new composty stuff and your native soil. So you don't have to turn it in. In fact, we prefer that you not break the soil. If you can avoid tilling, so much the better for the soil web, for soil structure. But if you choose something that has not just compost, but fertilizer added, and many bagged products you'll buy at places like my store, Davis Ace, or Home Depot will have that. Check the label, read the label as to what's in it. You can spread that over it, and you've basically fed the young plants when they go in just by doing that. And the next question I usually get is, should we turn this in? Well, you'll kind of do that as you plant. So what I've found is I just kind of dump, we have a product we called fur mulch, and we sell at our nursery. It's 85% fur compost, fully composted, and 15% chicken manure. So there's your organic nitrogen. I'll just dump that on the spot where a tomato is going to go 2-3 weeks later. When you go to plant, you're going to be taking your trowel and planting in that spot, and therefore it'll be mixing in around the roots of the young plant. That's pretty much all the incorporation we do if we have reasonable soil to begin with. I want to say, for those of you in, say, Southern California, where you don't have real soil in a lot of places, you're just on sand or sandstone, or if your interior have a sort of a gumbo like clay, I can fully understand how you may wish at some point in the process of making a garden to bring in a couple inches of something organic like this, spread it over the surface and incorporate it. That's very commonly done to improve the soil texture, to make a more workable soil. Soil tilth is the term we're looking for. It's not a very technical term, but it refers to how the soil feels. You want to get the roots off to a better start and so forth. I don't have a problem with doing that. And I think it's probably a good thing to do maybe the first time you plant your vegetable garden to get a better soil that is easier for you to work with. I grew up on a garden soil that was essentially some kind of fill my dad bought somewhere. All right. So I know that you sometimes have to create soil working with what you got. There were vacant lots in our neighborhood there in La Jolla, right near UCSD. They were essentially sandstone. They had rocks on them. All right, geology kids, they had rocks on them that were iron concretions, little round rocks that looked like irregular marbles that were literally just iron that had mineralized out of the soil because of the lack of rainfall, because of how dry the conditions are, because of the nature of the soil. They were just rolling around on the surface. If I said to someone, okay, let's go ahead and plant a vegetable garden there, you would laugh at me because you wouldn't be able to even
able to get your shovel into it.
Correct. So you have to start creating soil with whatever you got, wherever you're listening. And we are fortunate to be on some of the best farmland in the entire world here. So I can casually say, oh yeah, don't rototill. You just always do this. There are places I understand where you're essentially creating soil on top of whatever you have. And that would be perhaps a time you'll want to rototill or something and incorporate it. But let's just do that at the start and figure out ways you can avoid disturbing the soil web in the future by building the soil. That would be a short summary of how to deal with the no-till idea where you don't literally have a soil. Concern I have is anytime this comes up on the local, I don't know, next door Facebook group like that, someone will say, oh, the city gives away compost. They do. It's just compost. So if you use that, fine. The price is right, and there's really nothing wrong with it. They've actually properly composted it, put it through the, you know, bring it to the internal temperature, kept it moist, done everything to make it an actual compost.
Makes it a good mulch.
So you shouldn't be worried about weed seeds or pathogens in it. That's a question that commonly comes up. But it's almost sure to have almost no nitrogen. And that's the thing you'll need to add separately if you happen to go with a free source of actual compost. Okay.
So the second paragraph of this document says plant when the weather is right for that particular plant.
The key here and is it, key
it's
here.
Interesting the key. That you specify that because some plants like cool, some plants like hot, some plants are sort of in the middle.
They all like to go into warm soil at this time of year. That's the main thing. I like all of these summer vegetables and especially some of the summer flowers like zinnias, cosmos. I want them to go in and not stop growing. I don't want them to go through a transplant shock period. And those tomatoes I planted, you know, 2 weeks ago are going through a definite transplant shock period. I want them to go into soil that's warm and comfortable to your touch. I mean, that's one of the simplest things is just, are you turning the soil? Does it feel cold down there or is it warming up? And these summer things like zinnias are a really good example. They're a summer flower from Mexico. They don't like temperatures under 55 degrees, but they flourish when it's warm and they thrive when it's hot. So they should go into soil that's warm and comfortable, and that's usually mid-May or later, actually. Putting them in early, again, gains you nothing and might even set them back. So you do kind of need to know the individual plants. We try to stock this way. You know, I don't have a lot of zinnias out there right now, but we do get people that want to buy ahead for a project they're doing later. So just please understand that some things are more sensitive. Marigolds, for example, seem to be fine going into somewhat colder soil than do zinnias. My experience also, that's a great combination because marigolds bloom first, look great, kind of fizzling out by July. Zinnias are just coming in July and go right on into October. So try to mix some flowers this way if you're planting according to heat preferences, temperature preferences, but also be aware that early planting of some of the things that we're talking about, melons should not go into cold soil. Okra should not go into cold soil. It won't perform well at all. So just ask about that and look for those charts. We have one, redwoodbarn.com. The Yolo County Master Gardeners have one because we did it with them at the same time. So we produced it and they give it away. We all worked on that together. It was a joint project. It's a great chart. You can find laminated when to plant vegetables. I'd love to do a similar one for flowers, but you know, that's just a big project that isn't going to happen right away. But
that's similarly, a lot of flowers.
There's a lot of flowers that follow the same pattern as vegetables. Some can go in earlier, some need to go in later. So go, you know, find out what you can about the individual varieties. But the thing is, by mid to late May, the soil is warm enough for all of these things. So if you don't want to worry about it, just wait till we know it's warmer.
And you can always look in the Western Garden Book for your genera and species and find out when are you supposed to plant this particular plant. Don, I've got an abutilon that I want to plant. when should I plant my abutilon? Now, for those of you who have never heard this showy before, that is a bush that is one of my favorite bushes. It may be called a flowering maple where you are, or China bells. There's a lot of different names for it. But when do you plant a little bush of abutilon?
Well, for woody plants and for flowering perennials, it helps little if you know their origin. So if it's a subtropical plant, like abutilon is, it's better to wait until things are warmer. You and I know that they're very tough plants. They're not, you can probably plant them in December without any difficulty, but they are best planted when you're getting warm. This is true for citrus. This is true for hibiscus. This is true for any tropical and subtropical plants. For some of them, it's crucial, but others, they're hardier than we think. Lantana is a good example. People have been asking us for lantana. Blooms great here, draws butterflies, very popular garden plant. There's a whole lot of new varieties. People were coming in asking for varieties of lantana in late January and very heavily in early March when it was warming up. This is a truly subtropical to tropical plant. So not only will they not really gain anything from early planting, they would be set back by cold weather if it happened, if you planted in late January, early February. And they would struggle compared to just waiting a couple months and putting them in April or May. So knowing where the plant comes from, okra and watermelons, for example, truly tropical plants. Putting them in below 55 degrees will harm them. Others are subtropical. Subtropicals are on a spectrum. They can take a range of conditions. If you bought a bougainvillea in February because they had it at Home Depot and you put it in the ground, well, it probably yellowed a bunch of leaves, probably dropped them, probably doesn't look super great. But as soon as it warms up, that plant will come out and grow. I can tell you, we're not going to get any more frost. It's not going to be injured by the weather. It just wasn't particularly advantageous to plant it then. So it helps to know the plants and where they are on that subtropical spectrum. There's a lot of subtropical plants that are very, very popular in California. Some of them are even tropical, like the tropical hibiscus, which have become so incredibly popular. Putting them in early, really, not only do you not gain anything when you plant a tropical plant early, you might harm it for the entire season. Whereas if you wait until things are really warm and plant it, you'll get great results. It helps if you know. Experimentation is good. Talking to gardeners who know in your region, you know, when you put things in, that can be very helpful. But knowing the origin of the plant is something that will give you some guidance as to when and where to plant it.
Mm-hmm. And then plan and take action to control and prevent weeds. And I got to tell you, man, it's a little late for some of these things.
This one I would just mow. I mean, at this point, people are asking what to do about this weed or that weed. And we're in an in-between period. I mow off the annual winter growing weeds that are now flowering and going to seed. Regrettably, the foxtails, for example, the seeds are reaching the point where they're dangerous. So mow and bag if you possibly can. If you can't, please rake up. Mowing the seeds and removing them from the site probably reduces, you know, the future seed load, obviously. But the main thing is mowing everything down right now. Get as many of those seeds out of there as you possibly can. But we also are at the beginning of the germination of summer weeds. And one of the most frustrating things that early novice gardeners deal with is planting a whole vegetable garden, getting the soil all prepped, doing all this stuff, making paths, planting their vegetables, and having a whole bunch of weeds come up. Well, obviously, you've made conditions very favorable to weeds when you make conditions favorable for your vegetables and flowers. Red root pigweed is up. Knotweed is up. We'll see spurge shortly. Most of these are late spring germinating, summer growing weeds. They are pretty easy to control in the sense of just chopping them off mechanically. Most of them can be hoed off quite readily if you get to them in time. Their adaptive strategy is extremely rapid growth, early flowering, and reseeding. So, for example, spurge that comes up in May is already setting and distributing seed by the end of June. And each plant can produce 3,000 to 4,000 seeds is a data point I picked up somewhere a few years ago. Well, you know, you got 20 spurge plants in your garden, you now have 20 times a few thousand seeds. So getting them early with a hoe or burying them. Mulch works really well on seedlings. It works especially well on seedlings. Like 2 to 4 inches of arborist wood chips or whatever will kill them. And if you don't have those handy, get a tarp. Just anchor it down over them. They will die. It will kill them quite readily. A lot of times I'll get a question like, what do I do with my weeds? And my answer, the accurate answer that I would give is, what are they? Or I would say we need to identify the weeds. Because if you come in and you've got Bermuda grass, it's a different conversation than if you just have some pigweed coming up. Some of them are really easy. It's just a matter of getting after them quickly. Others, three big ones, Bermuda grass, bindweed, and nut sedge. You need a different strategy. Those are long-term things you're going to manage through the growing season. Cutting, repeated mowing, and mulching. And again, You may find landscape fabric for as a temporary thing. You may find a tarp as a temporary thing will be very helpful as well. So burying them does work, but get after them quickly because the summer growing weeds come up and go very fast. And so by the 1st of July, you go out there and your poor little pepper plants are being choked by them. Then you have to hand pull them. That's a chore. That's what your teenager doesn't want to do. So I would suggest going after them as they first come up with a hoe. A scuffle hoe is particularly good, action hoe or scuffle hoe. They're very good for that purpose. Hula hoe was the first brand of those. Very easy to use. You learn how to use them, both pulling and pushing. And they take seedlings out in no time. So that's a really handy tool for this purpose. But one of my favorites is a bale of straw. These things are all coming up. You get your vegetables planted. You take that bale of straw that you bought at the local feed store and you put 6 to 12 inches of straw all around that little tomato plant. I mean, so that it's just poking out of the straw itself. That will smother out weeds beautifully. So, and it's really simple and it breaks down and benefits the soil. So in this region, my opinion is straw is one of your best mulches for your vegetable garden. For woody plants and perennials and things like that, arborist wood chips are great. But in the vegetable garden and around flowers, it works very well as well. Several inches of straw mulch will effectively shade out many of the summer weeds, particularly the annuals that are coming up from seed in the month of May.
Landscape bare areas to reduce weed invasion. Yeah. Now, when you see a bare area, do you mean like, well, I had a summer garden and I'm not having a winter garden, so it's lying fallow? Or sure. Do you mean somebody scraped up something or it's a new area? What do you mean with a bare area?
All the above. Bare soil is an invitation to colonizing weeds, and weeds are classic.
So if your lawn is thinning out, that's also bare soil.
Oh yeah. When you take turf management classes and you become a turf manager, one of the key principles is that you'll have that weed management in turf is best accomplished by achieving greater turf density. If you've got a healthy lawn that you're mowing high, 3 to 4 inches high, and you've given it just the right amount of nitrogen so you have good vigor to the grass, and you've been seeding in to maintain sufficient density, you'll have very few weeds. If the lawn has thinned out for some reason, drought stress, or a species like tall fescue, which tends to get clumpy over time, if there's bare soil in between clumps of fescue, it will fill with weeds. So weeds are opportunists in turf. We all know that. They're also opportunists to bare soil areas. The areas in the city parks and green belts, for example, that have foxtails, they wouldn't if there were shrubs there. They wouldn't if they were landscaped. Now, the city can't do that necessarily. The city doesn't, one, have the resources or the funds. And in some of those cases, they need them to be open for visibility or whatever. There may be some reason. But if you don't plant something on bare soil in the Sacramento Valley, it will fill with grasses and mustard and certain other weeds.
Plant something or cover it up. You can cover it up with chips, and that's a good
one. And then the weed seeds will blow in on top of the chips and root into them, and those weeds will do really well. So, I mean, mulch and chips do work up to a point, but there is follow-up maintenance needed. You now have an open area that's inviting seeds to blow in and germinate. And I did an experiment on this a couple of years ago. It was not intended as an experiment, but it turned out to be one. Took a big tarp, covered a big area, March 1, didn't pull that tarp back until about May 1. And this is an area that had been very heavy with on my farm. It's typically oats, native grasses, mustard, and certain other weeds that I'm trying to get rid of. So this was very effective. It killed those weeds out completely. When we pulled it back, it seriously looked as though I had sprayed the area with an herbicide. It was that bare down to bare dirt. And I went ahead and planted some flowering things in there, but I didn't mulch or do anything. I left the open soil. Immediately, some mustard seedlings came up. Mustard is a real effective colonizer. That's why mustard is one of the most invasive plants in California. And a few little pieces of oats came up, but it was late in the season for them. And then certain other weeds, like the crane's bill, which is a type of geranium, seeded themselves in there. There are certain weeds that will fill in quickly in bare soil areas if you do nothing. Sensibly, I cut those down, but had I done nothing, those mustard plants would have grown, flowered, seeded, and become the dominant species in that area because it's a colonizing type of weed. Wherever you're listening, you have certain weed species that will do that. Pigweed is a good example in the summertime. There are certain other ground covering ones like spurge is definitely an opportunist in this regard. I have a picture that I show sometimes where I planted a Powis Castle Artemisia. It's a hybrid Artemisia with very aromatic foliage. It's a vigorous spreader. It's about 2 to 3 feet tall. Within 2 to 3 years, will be typically 3 to 4 feet across. I have it planted near this area where I pulled the tarp back. It's surrounded by grassy weeds and mustard, but nothing is growing through that plant. So So this is the point that I'm getting at here. There are low spreading woody plants that are dense enough, probably in the case of the Artemisia and some sages, to even have an allelopathic or chemical suppression of plants. And they make enough density over where they are growing that seeds don't germinate in them and grow through them. So they become what's dominant in that area. And good examples include things like that Powys Castle. It's all surrounded by grasses. I took the picture shortly before mowing the other grasses, but where it was, nothing was growing in it or through it. And there are certain other plants that will do this. So if we can plant those in common areas, great. If you can work on it yourself with the city, I do know there's people who start planting in some of the greenbelt and park areas, and sometimes the city will work with them and encourage it. Gaina, a longtime listener, has been making one little vacant area down in South Davis into a little native plant and native and low water plant garden, basically, by putting in things like this. If there's woody plants that are tall enough to spread out and shade the soil, they will suppress these weeds that are so problematic, particularly the grasses and the mustards and things like that. You have to do some follow-up work for the first summer or so because you know they're not magic, but there are plants like Artemisias, like some of our native salvias, the native sage plants, such as Salvia sonamensis, Salvia clevelandii, some of their hybrids. Nothing grows through them. And so these are a very effective way to have an attractive landscape that's great for wildlife, great habitat, good for pollinators, and doesn't have weeds. One that's been very effective on my property is some of the bigger forms of rosemary, the Tuscan blue rosemary. I have stands of that that are 10 feet across after a couple of decades. Nothing grows through them because they are so solid and they shade out the soil so completely. So there are these prostrate, dense, aromatic members of the mint family, typically members of the genus Salvia, especially, that can be used to eventually suppress weeds in an area. And what you do is you plant them 3 to 4 feet apart. You carefully irrigate them during their first summers. All the ones I've mentioned are really drought tolerant once established. Better to irrigate until establishment. Then you can back off and water as little as once a month. That's what I water some of these stands of rosemary on my property. And you can get in every now and then, trim around them, monitor for perennial weeds that are problematic, like Bermuda grass. But a good dense stand of these will even shade out some of those difficult perennial weeds eventually. So planting an area that's bare is the simplest way in the long run to get rid of weeds.
This is from Emily, who is in the Bay Area.
Yep.
And it says, hi, Don and Lois, I've made a garden mistake. I built raised beds this winter and filled them with bagged soil labeled, quote, raised bed mix, unquote, and lots of composted steer manure. I also used worm castings. I did not test my soil, but I'm guessing I have way too much nitrogen because all my leafy greens are now lush and lovely. Yes. But my carrots are the most disappointing thing you've ever seen. When you pull up a carrot, which has a decent visible shoulder and huge lush greens on top, the most spindly hard woody carrot comes out. They're covered with fine hairy roots. What should I do to remedy the soil for my next planting?
Yeah, so the raised planter mix, depending on the company, probably had some nitrogen source added. Most of the companies do that now. Some kind of organic fertilizer is in there. Steer manure is a great thing to use in your garden. It's about 1.5-2% nitrogen, and it releases fairly slowly. So that's a great thing. And then the worm castings are like 3% nitrogen, and they release at a sort of a moderate to slow pace. That's too much nitrogen for root vegetables. Yes, root vegetables grow great. As you found, they grow very lush in high nitrogen soil conditions, but they don't develop proper root systems. And so what you now need to do is draw down the nitrogen that you've inadvertently created in that bed, which is actually pretty easy to do. Your next crops will take up a lot of the nitrogen. If you remove their leafy residue and take it away, you're taking away the nitrogen, the excess nitrogen. And the plants that do that most efficiently are grasses. So any kind of grass planted on that bed, if you're in a coastal zone, you could even use annual rye grass or something like that. Here, we do that in the cool season, but in coastal areas, you could do it any time of year. If you don't mind growing for fun, corn is a really efficient way to take nitrogen away because you let it all grow. It loves all that nitrogen. It takes it up into the plant. It grows extremely vigorously. The thing is, you pretty much need to take that corn out of there and take all that vegetative matter away, thereby removing the nitrogen. You could test your soil, but nitrogen is one of the hardest things to test accurately for. You will not get an accurate soil test if you buy a kit or try and do it that way, because nitrogen moves quickly through its different stages. It volatilizes in the form of ammonia and drifts off. You're not going to get an accurate reading with a soil test. So you just go by performance. And I would do is fill that garden bed with corn would be what I would use here in the valley, but any of a number of grasses, they'll be green and leafy and they'll grow like crazy. And then you cut them down. And this is the important part. You take all that stuff away and use it somewhere else in the garden, where that nitrogen you put in your vegetable garden will now be carried off in the plant residue and of benefit to your fruit trees or some other part of the vegetable garden, which could make better use of the nitrogen. So that's the simplest way to remediate it, is to grow it out with a grass.
What about growing tomatoes or that sort
of
thing?
Yeah, that would be a mistake. They would grow like weeds and they wouldn't produce as well. So high nitrogen for tomatoes, and definitely don't do potatoes in this bed. Peppers might be fine. I would actually experiment a little bit, because peppers do respond to nitrogen input. And my guess is you'd get adequate yields, if not increased yields, by doing peppers in there. So that's worth a try. If I were in a coastal zone and I were doing peppers, I would focus on smaller fruited ones that don't need a really long season, like shishitos would be a good possibility. Gypsy is a good one. Sweet banana does very well, very, very productive. So that is a possibility, is just try different things and see what is not adversely affected by the high nitrogen. If you really want to grow root vegetables in that bed in the future, you need to draw that nitrogen down, and grasses will be the way to do that. But there are a lot of the other summer, I wouldn't put squash in there, for example. You would just get these monster plants. I definitely wouldn't do potatoes or tomatoes, because it would affect the yield. But I think with peppers or some of the other summer vegetables, you'd probably be fine. Be worth a try. Don't do beans. It's too much nitrogen for them, but you could try other things.
Watch for holy leaves.
Yep.
Wait a minute. H-O-L-E. Holy leaves, not H-O-L-Y.
Holy leaves, yes. We're getting people coming in who are planting things, and then things are eating the things they're planting. So there's two major ones that people get most commonly, and a couple of others. What's first on the list there?
Earwigs, snails, and slugs.
Yeah, those are the big guys. And if you're in coastal areas, snails and slugs are a year-round problem. They were my number one nemesis in my garden in coastal San Diego. In the interior, they tend to be more seasonal because they don't like hot, dry weather, but they are coming out now. They're loving the weather we're having as we prepare this broadcast. Snails and slugs are out there in force. Earwigs also come out, and all these feed at night. So people just go out and they find the holes in the leaves and they wonder what has caused it. Simplest thing to do is to take a flashlight and go out at night and look. But I realize some of you might be, say, at the community garden, might not be your first choice, or you may not be the kind of person who likes to wander through your garden at midnight.
Or you might be sleeping, Don.
Yeah, I don't understand that. But going out at night, the first thing in the morning, they're often still present as well. You can tell a little bit by the nature of the damage. Snails have pretty big mouth parts. They can eat pretty big holes in a leaf. They can eat from the side of the leaf or from the middle of the leaf. So I can pretty much recognize snail and even slug damage when I see it. And they tend to leave somewhere on the plant or on the way there a shiny residue. Earwigs make smaller holes, but there can be very large numbers of them. And the same earwig will feed on that same spot, you know, until the hole gets pretty big. Their holes, however, are typically smaller than those of snails and slugs. And the only reason this matters is that you would rather use rather different approaches to both of them. Snails and slugs, we have very low toxicity bait, iron phosphate based materials such as Sluggo that work well. You can, of course, go out in sunrise or middle of the night, find them and kill them directly if they're not that hard to control that way, at least here in the valley. Earwigs tend to be fairly local to where you have the problem. They have a den or a nest somewhere nearby. And when you go out, you wonder why that marigold just disappeared. Well, you go out at night with a flashlight, you'll see 14 or 15 earwigs on a single marigold plant eating the foliage. Smaller holes, typically, no shiny trail left behind, no droppings or anything like that. Just a whole lot of damage in one sort of localized area is typically earwigs. They're actually pretty easy to monitor if you don't want to go out at night with a flashlight, because you can attract them with oil. They're very attracted to aromatic cooking oil, like olive oil, or, you know, if you want to use walnut oil or something like that. This isn't the time for your delicate safflower oil. You use the strongest smelling oil you have, corn oil, if anybody still uses that. Soybean oil wouldn't do it. You want something, as I say, with an aroma. You put just a film of that, like a quarter inch or less, in the bottom of a flat bowl would be ideal, will be the simplest. And you
paper
put it out.
Plate.
or a paper plate or paper bowls. This is one case where paper bowls might be very appropriate. Put that in there, set it by the plant at sunset, and go out and check it in the morning. And if you have an earwig problem, there'll be at least a few that have crawled in being attracted to the oil fragrance and will drown. Sometimes you'll find 10, 20, or 30 of them in there, and that's very satisfactory. And if you leave it there, if you're not too grossed out by this, you'll get more because they're attracted to what's going on in there. So you can actually not only monitor the population really effectively and figure out if earwigs are part of your problem, you have pretty good control that way as well. Start looking around nearby. Are there boards or something stacked up over there? Is there some brick or rock in a little pile? Is there the kind of debris that would shelter them and make a place for their making a den? Because my experience with earwigs is the damage tends to be right in this area. That means they're coming from somewhere nearby. They don't wander as far into the garden as snails and slugs are capable of doing. So to some degree, removing their habitat can be effective. And also, you can kill earwigs by squishing them. I know they have pincher things on the back, so wear gloves. They're not trying to pinch you, but they're just going to use that to menace you. But if you walk out and you just squeeze an earwig in the middle wearing gloves, you will kill it. So that's one simple thing you can do. But the other thing to remember about them is they're very seasonal here. They start when you first plant summer vegetables, early to mid-April, and they continue through mid to late May. But that 4 to 6 week window, unfortunately, of course, we're very active in our gardens at that time, but then they tend to diminish considerably as we get into late May. They disperse. This is when you start finding them in the garage or trying to come in the house. The females are trying to find a place to make a new den. They're not doing a lot of damage in the garden. Many sites online will tell you, oh, earwigs are beneficial. Well, yeah, they do feed on thrips and mites and other things. They also feed on your plants. So they're beneficial and harmful at the same time. It's certainly possible for both conditions to exist. They like seedling peppers. They like seedling basil. They'll do some damage to young tomatoes. They demolish marigolds. So there are certain plants they're very attracted to. It is true that they climb into your rose flower and eat the thrips that were damaging the bloom. But while they're there, they also eat some of the rose petals. So most people aren't real thrilled about the purportedly beneficial aspects of earwigs, and they gross people out. They're not aggressive. They're not trying to pinch you. They're not harmful in any particular way to people, but they do damage young seedlings for about a 4 to 6 week period in the spring. Consider the oils as oil traps as a simple way to deal with those.
So a Davisite wrote in and said, hello, after last year's tomato catastrophe, we are considering the alfalfa bale method. Wondering if you sell bales in which we can grow tomatoes, and also the fertilizer juice that is recommended for seasoning the bales. What the heck are they talking about? Tomato roots are 4 feet long, and a bale of hay is not that big.
Well, it's about 2 feet deep. So straw bale gardening was a big thing 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and sort of caught on. A lot of garden writers like to write about it. Straw bale instead of hay bale is what's usually used. There is subtle differences between those two. No, of course, we don't stock them because we have a little tiny nursery, but you can get them at feed stores. For example, locally in the Dixon area, Higbee's Country Feed outside of Dixon. There's a feed store in Davis that I believe can probably get a hold of them for you. It was interesting when this became, I'll call it a trend for a little while, that people would try this. It started in, as with so many, like square foot gardening and some of these others, in a rainier climate, a place where it actually rains in the summer. And so the first notable thing about straw bale gardening in the valley was that you had to water like crazy. People who did it wrote about it. And if you happen to go into the archives of the Sacramento Bee from several years ago, Debbie Arrington, who was writing for them and editing at that time, walked us through her whole summer of straw bale gardening, what the experiences were, what the ups and downs of it were. It worked very well, and many people gave us that feedback. But yes, things root through it very quickly into the ground below. So the straw bales are best done sitting on dirt. You do put soil in there, sitting on dirt. In our area, that's really the only way, in my opinion, it's likely to work. Now, we did have a listener a few years back that sent us some pictures of where they had done it, I think, on their driveway, which works if you give them the water they need. Just as with square foot gardening, a very popular approach in other parts of the country, it needs daily water. No question. Absolutely needs daily water because the straw bale dries out too quickly. But a deep-rooted plant, in Debbie Arrington's case, if I recall, pumpkins did great. Well, you know, they had gone right through the straw bale, probably rooted into the ground below very quickly. Other things were more of a challenge. So we're in a hot, dry climate. where keeping things growing through a July and August heat is going to be challenging. I know you'll need to water daily. The drip line goes across the top and this trickles down to the plants that you've put into little pockets of soil that you've carved out in the straw bale, and it roots into that and then roots right on through. Daily watering is really the key. I would probably use a Netafim style emitterized tubing because it has emitters every 6 to 12 inches. I'd go with the closest spacing you can. Low output doesn't matter. It's just you're going to run it daily for 35 to 45 minutes in order to get that whole zone watered. But what they did find, it's warm and the roots can go deep quickly if they're watered correctly. And you're generally adding this charge of fertilizer because the straw bale itself doesn't have any. So you're either adding soils that contain fertilizer or you're continuing to fertilize somewhat through the season. But the plants were very vigorous and the plants did well. And overall, their experience was it worked reasonably well. It took a lot of water. Convenient thing, if you happen to be, let's say, a tenant, and your landlord hasn't given you a place that you can plant a vegetable garden, well, you know, you can do this in the middle of your lawn, okay? You can stack these things up in the lawn and plant on top. Lawn sprinklers would probably be fine. I don't know. I haven't tried that. End of the season, the straw bale just disintegrates. You just allow it to incorporate into the soil, or you rake it up and you put it over on the compost pile and you reseed the area and the lawn is restored. So it's one of the simplest things to clean up afterwards if you decide you're no longer going to do straw bale gardening in that spot. It did take a lot of water. It did take ongoing fertilizer and not everything worked well. So the results were not exactly the same as people got, let's say, east of the 100th meridian where it rains in the summer. But we did have people try it. And I think that's really the key, is that you have to provide, as with any raised planter, the nutrients and the moisture. It's just even a little trickier with straw bale gardening.
Well, it's April. It is still April. It's the 22nd. And we have pictures of plants that Don took and put on a calendar. So his April calendar includes, and I'm just going to read them real fast, and then we can come back and decide which one you want to talk about.
Okay.
Peony, ranunculus, tulip, clivia, rosa, carpenteria, clematis, bluebells, iris, sweet alyssum, cereus, pelargonium, berberis, viola, and aquifolia.
Aquilegia, that's columbine.
Aquilegia, excuse me.
Columbine blooms in the month of April. That's one I would like to talk about a little bit. It's a fantastic garden plant for light shade. Morning sun is best for it here. Coastal zones, of course, it can take full sun. But the fact that it will grow and bloom in the shade is one of its big features, since there aren't that many flowers that do. We have native columbine that are really cool. The Western columbine is a great plant, does very well here. It's much taller than garden hybrids. When I've grown
it. Is it the orange one?
Yeah. And when I've grown it, it gets to about 3 feet tall. The flowers are smaller than the modern hybrids, but still good size. And they're bright orange. So, you know, they really do stand out in the garden. My experience with it, as with other columbines, is they're typically a 2 to 3 year perennial. They're one of those kinds of things. They'll grow the first year. They may or may not bloom the first year. You can buy them and bloom. They come back the second year. By the third year, they're typically declining, but still blooming. But if you're a nice shaggy gardener that doesn't deadhead everything and doesn't keep everything perfectly fastidious in your garden, columbine will reseed very happily. Ooh. And it'll naturalize in the shade. It will naturalize here and there. If you start with the Western columbine, it will reseed and come true to type, and it will scatter itself here and there. But each plant of that is 2 to 2 feet across or more. It's a big columbine. It's a big plant. Attractive foliage. I mean, the plant itself is worth growing, but larger than the modern garden hybrids. It will reseed true to type. Hybrids that you buy, either in bloom or in little packs or single plants, will not reseed true to type. They will come back a mix, typically. They're usually F1
hybrids. But they will reseed.
They will reseed, and the color mix will change. So I remember working in a garden in San Diego where they had planted columbine, and it was now when I was working there 5 or 6 years later, and all of their columbine were yellow. The entire yard, it was beautiful, but they were all yellow, and they had started out with mixed colors because I gather that strain reverts gradually to one of the yellow parents. I was fine. They were perfectly happy with that, but be aware that the color mix may change. Hummingbirds love them. There's a nectar reward way down at the end of that spur. Lots of other bees like them, like the Xylocopa bees, which will go in and rob nectar from them. Have you ever seen this where they do this? Yeah. They go up to a flower and rather than sticking a proboscis down, they go down to the bottom, like tear a hole in the bottom of the flower, steal the nectar that way without even pollinating it. Lazy little bees. But they like this, the columbine.
Well, little kids do that too.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So they're basically like garden kids. Not doing their job, but having fun out there. So the columbine is a great one, but bear in mind, it's an April to early May bloom. And my experience has been it's kind of it, May to June, maybe in some years. But don't pick off the seed heads. The plant itself may come back for another year or two, and the seedlings will come up. If you grow them yourself from seed, the reason I want to mention this, people are asking about planting them now, fine, but they take generally over a month to germinate. So be aware of that. So I would say if you really want columbine in your garden and you're listening in the shade garden category, Gaina, are you paying attention? Then you would plant columbine from seed in mid to late summer in pots or directly in the ground if you're good at that. But in pots would probably be safer for planting out if you're doing them in pots in September, October. Get them off to a good start. They'll bloom the following spring. They'll function like biennials, even though they are technically short-lived perennials. Actually is true of a lot of biennials. So if you really want to have these flowering perennials, these wonderful columbine in your garden, mark your calendar for, let's say, July 15th to get the seed so you get it going and we can walk you through the process then because I want your garden full of columbine next year.
Well, if I went to a store and they had columbine in little 4-inch pots, couldn't I just buy it and plant it now?
Yes, of course. And we do, as do most garden centers, and they're coming into bloom. So it'll grow, it'll bloom. The plant will not reach its full size potential when you do that, but it will bloom very nicely. So when you're doing this in a garden plan, you might want to go a little closer together because you're going to put in a, let's say, a 4-inch or a quart pot size columbine. It's going to be coming into bloom when you buy it, very likely. It's just going to do that.
Well, you can see what the color is.
That's right. You can see, and you can move them around. Some of them are blooming, you know, as you purchase them, and they'll bloom for a few more weeks, which is, by the way, the characteristic pattern with most plants. 4 to 6 weeks is a normal bloom cycle for a lot of things. We've all gotten to the point where we expect everything to bloom like all year round. Thank you to the bedding plant industry for achieving this. But many plants have their own half season of bloom. Columbines, it's the mid to late spring. And you can plant them now. And just as I say, even if they look like they're dying and they're done, let them go to seed and the seedlings will come up fairly near the main plant. The issue with columbine as a design plant is that the leaves can look pretty rough by mid to late summer on the plant that you put in the spring. We get spider mites, and if it's really hot and dry, some of those leaves will stress. Mulch around them, plant them with other plants where you'll be giving them a little extra attention with the watering. They go great with heucheras. Coral bells are the best known form of heucheras, but also the ornamental version. They actually go well with our native ferns, the California native ferns that do well here in the valley. So they can be part of a really nice planting of shade perennials and annuals, but they'll be done blooming by midsummer. So plan for something else to go with them to be blooming at that time.
Are these the kind of plants that once they're looking really rough, they're done flowering and the leaves are, is this the kind of plant where you cut it down to a couple of inches and it comes back?
Yes, some people do that and it actually works. Sometimes it stresses the plant to the point where it just doesn't go well. But I've done this with a lot of things that get thrips and spider mite injury here in the summer. My feeling is, it's looking ugly, I would pull it out, but why not just cut it back and see what happens? And very commonly, especially with thrips, you cut it back and you wash it off and that garden gets a little extra fertilizer or something, it comes right back and looks great. That's a very simple way to manage that August yuck, as we've called it in many years past over the radio program, the August yuck problem in your garden. Print it out.
So it's April and I wanted to say a word to you because I haven't seen this picture on your April calendar. Mock orange, Philadelphus.
And also Pittosporum, both blue.
But no, Philadelphus.
Well, I like them both.
12
I have...
feet tall and fumes in my, aromas in my front.
Fragrance.
It's amazing.
Fumes makes it sound like gasoline.
No, it's fragrance. It's very, very light, very sweet.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah, Philadelphus and Pittosporum, which are both called mock orange, are both blooming. I have both of them on my property. I have an enormous Pittosporum tibira that's just past its peak of bloom, and the fragrance of that has been stunning. And there's a Philadelphus sort of lost behind it, which also blooms. It has a sweet and pleasant and rather more sophisticated aroma. They both do well here. Philadelphus would prefer, in my experience, a little shade from extreme heat just to keep the foliage looking good. But the plants are indifferent. They don't really care. It's actually a very tough and adaptable plant. And it's big. This is the problem with using it in landscape design, is that like forsythia and some of the other well-known deciduous flowering shrubs, these are big shrubs that are used in informal hedges back east, or so I'm told, but get too big for our yards here very commonly in California. And they don't take that well to hard pruning. You'll minimize the bloom if you prune them too hard. You should put in a Philadelphus. We have a native one. There's also the East Coast one, which is actually more popular because of the heavier bloom and the greater fragrance. They both do well, but they should be planted in a place where they can grow as naturally as possible, is my personal opinion. If you do need to prune them for size control, and this goes for any deciduous flowering shrub in general, if it's a once a year bloomer, as the Philadelphus is, and it's deciduous, you just wait till it's done blooming and then prune it. And you can prune it for size control. That would just be a matter typically of cutting back all those long branches by 25 to 50% to try and induce some branching. You can shear them if you have some weird reason for wanting to do that. Fine. Don't do it until after they bloom. Otherwise, you're just cutting off, you're just cutting off seasonal bloom. So that goes for flowering quince, that goes for spirea, that goes for forsythia, that goes for Philadelphus. Bach orange or Pittosporum tobira, Pittosporum, Pittosporum tobira. Print it however you want, whenever you want. But if you want to maximize the bloom, I suppose you would likewise wait until it's done blooming. Most people don't actually grow Pittosporum for the bloom. They grow it as a hedge plant or just a big evergreen thing. The bloom is a nice bonus, and it smells just like lemon blossoms, hence the name Mock Orange.
Well, there are lots of pictures on the April calendar, and most of them are pretty common, and people would look at that and recognize mm-hmm. the name. But there's one in here that I think a lot of people wouldn't recognize. That's the Carpinteria.
Yeah, that's a native shrub, Carpinteria californica. It's native to the east side of the Coast Range, interestingly. Most of the coastal native shrubs that are so popular in garden centers in California are from the west side of the Coast Range.
That's the wet side. The cooler side.
Yeah, or they're native to Southern California chaparral, for example. This one is native to the east side, so it is quite drought tolerant. It's called bush anemone. It's very pretty right now. Pool plant if you have a low water landscape or particularly a California native plant landscape. Today's quote, Lois?
The man who has planted a garden feels that he has done something for the good of the whole world. And that's a quote from Charles Dudley Warner.
Just the man?
No, a person who plants a garden knows that she's done something for the good of the whole world.
There we go.
Or at least for the bees.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California. Hey, Don. I hear that there's a big dog coming to town.
Big dog coming to town? Uh-oh.
Well, that's a good thing.
Oh, okay.
That's the big day of giving. And you know, anytime that the big day of giving happens, you can go and you can donate to KDRT, DMA, Tree Davis, all of those organizations that exist in our area and survive by the charity of our community.
The generosity of our community. So the big day of giving is May 7. May 7, when we're all turning to you out there to help keep KDRT on the air, help keep trees going in the ground, help keep the local TV station on the air. Big day of giving, May 7. More information next week. Please help us out on Big Day of Giving.